think as parents, we want to pause and ask ourselves, what does learning look like?
There is a lifetime to learn. You have a lifetime to learn things you're interested in.
And grabbed it, and like, you just, if you saw the smile emanating from my daughter this morning, it was beaming with pride.
Do to yourself what you do for your kids. Don't put boundaries on yourself. Don't make yourself feel like you have to be perfect.
Everybody, and welcome back to Sensory Play Reimagined, a podcast exploring how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm your host, Rachel Rothman. I'm a toy expert and mom of three. And on today's episode, I am so thrilled to have three incredible moms and entrepreneurs and people who are working incredibly hard and beautifully to support children and their development in various ways. And I'm just so thrilled to have each of you. And I know you guys are all friends. So I'm going to kick it off to Lindsay. Lindsay, if you don't mind introducing yourself, what it is that you do, kind of your background, and we'll go through everybody. And then maybe you can share kind of the story of how all three of you are connected.
Great. I'm so excited to be here. I love sensory play. So it's a great topic. I own a kids art studio called The Craft Studio. We have three physical locations in the New York City area, but we pop up all over. And, you know, what we do is parties, classes, camps, events. But our mission is really to get kids' hands dirty. Everyone is an artist. There are no mistakes in art. Perfect is boring. And we just love being a space where kids can completely disconnect and play.
I love that. I love that. Thank you. Rachel, I'll pass to you next.
Sure. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Rachel Lipson. I founded a music school for children called Blue Balloon Songwriting School, and we teach kids mostly ages 3 and up with in-home music lessons how to play instruments through writing their own songs, which means from day one, whether they're 3 years old, whether they're 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old, they are learning how to play an instrument, and at the same time, they're making up their own songs and exercising the creative part of their brain. And as Lindsay said, there's, you know, mistakes are great. It's part of creativity. It's what we look for. And we do in-home music lessons, and we're in 6 cities. New York City is our main location. And then we do the Hamptons, and we're in Miami and Austin and Westchester and Connecticut and a couple other places. And I'm just happy to be here and to chat with you all about play, which is my favorite.
Thank you. And Caitlin, if you can introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, everybody. So I am a specialist in strengths-based learning and neurodiversity-affirming practices, executive functioning skills, and giftedness. So basically, I am a parent coach and an instructional leader. Instructional leadership just means teachers who teach other teachers. And I am the founder of a private tutoring and educational consulting practice in New York City called Joyfully Learning. And I am a mom of 2 amazing kiddos. I have a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old. And as you can tell from the name of my practice, Joyfully Learning, the idea of joy and play in all of our learning is central to everything I do. So I'm just so excited for this conversation.
I'm so thrilled to have all of you. So maybe we can dive in. Caitlin, even you just saying like strengths-based approach. I think a lot of people hear it. If you don't mind kind of diving into like, what does that actually mean in one, what does it mean? And then 2, what does that look like in practice?
Sure. So taking a strengths-based approach means we begin our relationship with a child by identifying their strengths and then guiding them in using those strengths to grow in other areas where they need to or want to grow. So one of the sort of simplest ways to think of it is that a strengths-based approach would be to say to a child, wow, you are really strong at this. And let me show you how that can help you over here. Whereas its opposite, which would be a deficits-based approach, would be to say, here are all the ways you're failing to meet my expectations, and now I have to help you catch up. Now, when I say that to you, which gets you more engaged in learning with me, right? Like, it's a no-brainer, right? But unfortunately, it's not what's happening in a lot of our schools and our kids' other learning spaces. So a big part of what I'm doing is working with parents and also going to schools and doing professional development for teachers in how we can take a more strengths-based lens to the work that we do with our kids.
I think it's so beautiful. Again, a lot of it is just through like the reframing of how you're saying something, how you're approaching something. And it's like every child, every person has so many incredible strengths, and let's lean into it. let's really unpack that and help, you know, build their confidence within that domain. I think, it, again, it's just such a, when you hear it, like you just said, you're like, it's a no-brainer. It's like, why isn't everybody doing it? But I think you have to be thoughtful enough to kind of think through the approach and kind of do it in the way in which you're describing. So I absolutely love that. And maybe Rachel and Lindsay, kind of similarly, I know that both of you kind of curate the practice of whoever you're working with to the individual. Like it's something, like you said, like we want to empower every individual to reach, you know, whatever it is that their potential is. How do you help unlock that? How do you see it? So, you know, Caitlin, you were just sharing like how you might see that they're, you know, they're particularly adept at something, or they're motivated by something and they're interested and invested in it. How kind of in the other domains of what you guys are seeing, Rachel and Lindsay, are you able to identify it and then kind of support and nurture that?
Yeah, So with music lessons, when I took music lessons when I was a kid, you know, a kid of like the 80s and 90s, the lessons were very traditional. It was, these are the pieces you need to learn. This is the curriculum that's set out for you. Everybody's kind of learning the same thing. It didn't matter what my interests were. It didn't matter what kind of music I liked, what my strengths were, what kind of, how creative I was. It didn't matter. The goal was to practice until I could do X, Y, Z. And that is what mattered. And when I started to teach music lessons 15 years ago or so, when I started my company, my goal was to give kids the opposite experience. What happens when you hand a child an instrument and you say, here's your instrument. Now, what do you like to do? What do you want to do with this? What things do you already do that you love, that you feel good at, that can make you feel connected to this instrument and connect you to music so that it becomes a positive experience from day one? So this way, you have kids who are using a poem that they wrote or a little silly rhyme that they made up or writing a song for their stuffed animal, and they're taking that connection that they have with their life and their creativity, and they're turning it into something that is educational and something that will help them learn and connect to music long term.
I love that. Is there a way in which you empower parents to say, like, kind of the benefits of it? I think the benefits speak for themselves. You have kids who are engaged in it, who are joyful of it. They are, you know, engaging in creativity. They are learning. But for those that are more like outcome based and or can't kind of understand it, like how do you explain to them the benefit of this approach?
Yeah. So what I try to remind people is that almost everybody has an experience, if they took piano lessons as a kid, whatever instrument they took, of being forced to play and hating it. And a lot of parents come into parenthood and come into music lessons for their kids with that experience. So if I remind them about what that felt like and how they stopped, and how they didn't identify themselves as a musician anymore after that point. They felt like this was something I did, now I'm gonna do something else. What I want people to feel is that when their kids take music lessons, when they're songwriting, and when they're learning how to play in a creative way, they will always feel a connection to music and they will always feel that passion, and it continues even if they decide to do other activities. They don't have that feeling of a kind of hatred for, I hate to say that, but that, you know, that feeling of like, ugh, like where they feel allergic to it, right? Which so many adults have. And so I try to remind parents of that and tell them that there is a lifetime to learn. You have a lifetime to learn things you're interested in. And while your children are children, you can force them to do things and make them do one thing or another. But as they get older, they will have their own point of view and they will decide what they want to do, you know, with their time. And so if it's something that they have a positive experience with and it's something they have a positive association with, it's more likely that they will come back to it and it'll be something that long term they will keep as a part of them.
So I think if I could jump in, I think Rachel said a really interesting thing when she said that they stop identifying as a musician because they disengage from it, right? And this is something we talk about in our work too. And I think Lindsay was a little bit in what you were saying too about everybody's an artist, right?
Yeah.
Is that kids have a tendency to adopt language that limits them at a very young age. Oh, I'm not a math person. I'm not a musician, right? And what happens is then we start to limit our opportunities, right? Oh, well, instead of just saying like, I haven't learned how to multiply these fractions yet, right? Now we're saying like, oh, I can't multiply fractions. So I'm just not a mathematician. So I just can't major in
you know, whatever in college. So I can't be a, you know, whatever job I might have, right? And so why do we have like a 6-year-old or a 12-year-old narrowing that sense of themselves, right? And the way that we can, one of the ways we can avoid that, yes, being strengths-based, absolutely, but this idea of self-direction, which I think is sort of the undercurrent of what Rachel's talking about, right? That noticing what our children are choosing and are drawn to and why, and then providing them what they need to continue to explore that, right? And not trying to control every aspect of how they explore it, right? So there's a big difference between providing what they need, facilitating their pursuing this thing that they're interested in, right? Versus like, oh, now I'm going to control it. So it's going to be this lesson at this time with this teacher, and this is the product I'm looking for at the end of it, right? When I say that to parents, they get a little nervous because they go, well, self-direction sounds great, but then what if they miss out on something that they could have loved or been great at because they didn't self-direct to it, right? So we want to talk about the distinction. You can put a lot of different things in your children's world and environment and see what they're drawn to, right? That's very different than, okay, fall semester, you're taking lacrosse, spring semester, you're taking piano, right?
Yeah. I think, like you're saying, providing exposure to a lot of different things and seeing what they gravitate towards. And then, like you said, a child isn't going to naturally pick up a flute. Like there has to be a flute there for them to play, you know? So like,
right.
Obviously with it, there is the, you know, setting up the environment and giving them the access and the exposure to all these things, but then seeing what it is that they're picking up on and providing them kind of choice within that domain.
And now a word from our sponsor, EduShape, the original sensory company. EduShape is a 40-year-old expert in child development toys. It started working as a trusted supplier of daycares and preschools and has since expanded to support families and special education globally. It has been featured on The Today Show, The New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Good Housekeeping, and more. Their toys are rated 5 stars by millions of consumers. Shop today and score a quality toy for your little one at a great price.
I was going to say, Lindsay, maybe also with you, like, I think we've kind of touched on it but like similarly, and even as we were describing, a lot of us have artwork kind of in frame right now, around the concept of just like letting them kind of, at what point do they kind of take over a project? Are they involved in the project? Like, what does that actually look like? Somebody comes into the space, and how much is, you know, provided and structured? How much is not, and they're allowed to dive in? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. So, you know, at our studio, kids can experience, and adults too, can experience art in different ways. They can come into a drop-in that's self-guided, or they can take a class where there's step-by-steps. But all of our interactions with kids are what we're talking about. We don't set limits. And I always use this example because it's so old school, and it's about kind of reframing, you know, Caitlin, like you were talking about, this thought and these preconceived notions of what art is. And from the grown-up's point of view, a child will be picking out paint, and let's say they're painting an apple and they'll choose purple, and the parent will be like, oh, you know, like, no, there's no purple apples. But it's about, you know what, that's amazing, of course you can make a purple apple, why haven't I thought of that? And just sort of invigorating in the adults too, you know, like we said, we're all artists. There are no mistakes in art. Like, we're going to do this project. For example, we're doing this adorable multimedia. They're doing a crayon box this week where they have a base of a box and they're rolling out clay crayons and dig by all these different materials. But the beginning of every single lesson is, if we all had the same project, how boring of a world would it be? You know, I hope all of ours look so different. But it's really sometimes hard for a child adult to kind of, they're like, wait, you know, and it's about educating the parent. It's more for us at our studio about the experience and letting kids disconnect and invigorate that creative side of the brain. Because I truly believe that when kids get their hands dirty and play, whether it be with art or in the dirt or, you know, it really ignites and fires the brain on all cylinders. But exactly. We may have a guided project that we're working towards, but it's certainly not. And there is a place. I love the paint and sip. I've done it. It's so fun. But we're not copying a project so they all look the same. It might be, you know, we're using the same materials, but we hope that they all look different because, you know, that's the real beauty in art, I think.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think a lot of what we've been, all of us have kind of touched on, is just being mindful of the way in which we are presenting and discussing something. Like, I think we're all around, maybe not in our generation, but a generation above us or two above us, where there is a lot of framing of, oh, they're the mathematician. Oh, they're the, you know, the soccer player. Oh, they're the whatever. And it does limit them. And then that's creating also kind of that echo chamber of, this is what I am, this is who I am, this is what defines me, as opposed to, we are all kind of the sum totality of everything that we are. So it's funny, whenever, I'm sure, Caitlin, you could provide better tips and advice, so please do so right afterwards. But whenever I kind of hear it and it's like, oh yeah, well, she's the gymnast, I'm like, yeah, she's really enjoying gymnastics, and she's really, you know, I'll tap onto it, and I'm like, yeah, and also the, you know, we're really loving our swim lessons and whatever it might be. But like, Caitlin, maybe I'm sure you do have in your pocket, like, what are some of the strategies for kind of countering that? Like, how can one, being mindful, I think, is first and foremost, and recognizing there are going to be times when we're going to, I'll say, slip and say something, we're like, oh, and catch yourself for it. But are there frameworks, are there ways of saying and approaching and or thinking through things that you find particularly helpful as you're coaching people in terms of how they can create that space where kids feel like, I can do anything, I can be anything, I am anything, I am good at many things, et cetera?
So I'm like having a very personally resonant moment right now listening to you talk. I'm having this realization about myself that, like, I definitely in my 20s had to do some work for myself on what I think of as like personal mythology. How much of my personal mythology was created by what people around me had said about me? And then I had to do this work of like, wait, how much of that is what I value in myself? And how much is like, I've taken that on because I've heard other people praise it about me or mention it about me.
I came to that about 15, 20 years later than you, but like, I'm doing the work. So I, yes, I very much appreciate it.
So, you know, having gone through that for myself, and to be fair, those things were almost entirely positive that other people said, but they still weren't necessarily what I valued, and they were creating stress for me, right? I felt sort of locked into like, oh, I'm this or I'm that, and so I have to do this or have to behave this way, right? So I came into parenthood having like had that realization for myself and not wanting to do it that way for my kids as much as I could avoid it. So I think that now I'm like having this realization that very much has influenced sort of the trajectory of the work that I do with other parents and with kids. Not what you asked me, personal moment.
So I appreciate it. And I think through that, I have been so cognizant for that very reason of helping provide intrinsic motivation for my children, you know, and making sure that it's not always looking for that external validation, that like, what do they honor the most? It's what's inside of them. And it was a lot of work that I had to do unpacking myself and also in support of what I wanted them to see, because I didn't want them to get to 20, 30, 40 and be like, I'm living my life for other people. I wanted to be like, I'm living my true life. I'm living my authentic person of who I want to be and what I want to put out there.
Yes. And I had gotten so good at performing my learning, right? I was very good at performing my learning. And I thought I knew how to do education because I knew how to get stickers on my reading logs and my pencil lines never straight out of my like little standardized test sheet bubbles, right? But I think as parents, we want to pause and ask ourselves, what does learning look like? Because it looks so many different ways. And what Rachel and her team see in lessons, not only does that look different than what Lindsay and her team see in the craft studio, but one lesson to another, what Rachel sees, I'm sure learning looks different, right? And one child to another, the craft studio, what Lindsay sees looks different, right? So I think one of the things for us as parents, because we are very schooled, we're very indoctrinated, right? We have an entire lifetime of having gone through a school system and having an idea of like what this looks like. And for most of us, not all of us, for most of us, that was very performance-based. Here's how I perform this learning to somebody else's standard, right? To step back and go, wait, what are all the different beautiful ways that my child's learning can look, right? And a lot of times, and this might sound funny, that's about like pausing ourselves or shutting up, which is hard, right? But going like, okay, wait, let me hold space for what my child's going to share or say or do without speaking it or controlling it. Again, like, I just think that's a really common theme.
Yeah, learning to passively observe my children or actively listen, but like not engage with, was something that like I had to work very hard on. And I'm continuing to work on it. But I think one, it unpacks and you can learn so much about it. And to your point of like growth and learning comes in so many different facets. So like my children have not been in school for the last 2 months. I have seen such growth. I have seen such development. And I think as a society, we continue to hold such a standard to the academic excellence and to the, you know, the testing and whatever have you. And I have three children who are radically different learners, radically, like each of them so different and distinct. And I think through that, it has given me this gift of saying like, learning is happening everywhere and growth is happening everywhere. And so again, to have a summer where there was very little academic kind of involvement, but to also see the social emotional growth and the growth in independence and the growth in executive functioning skills because of some of the things that we had set up in terms of kind of our household and what we were doing and how we were going about the world. So I think so often we kind of put the end product, like you said, kind of that performative metric of whatever it is at the end as like the ultimate goal, but to kind of reconsider and to take that moment to say, wow, like I have this child who is growing, is developing, is thriving when we kind of take away that metric at the end of did they get an A plus on the test or something like that.
So I can give you a beautiful example from my own son's life. And Lindsay, I bet this is going to resonate for you too. Okay. So my younger son always wanted to play with the coffee pods, you know, the Nespresso pods. And I never wanted him to because I'm like, listen, those are expensive. And if one of them pops open, that's going to be a huge mess. And like, I don't want to deal with it. It was always like, no, you cannot play with the coffee pods. You have a room full of toys. Like, leave these alone. One day I took that pause and I just went, you know what? Like, I'm just going to let him play with the coffee pods. I probably was like in a frantic moment going like, I need a break and this will keep him occupied. He was a preschooler, right? So I gave in and let him do it. And I stayed out of it. And you know what he did? He taught himself division at 4 because That's he took amazing. The coffee pods and he had them on the table. And he's going, if daddy drinks 3 of these a day, I'm not the coffee drinker, my husband is, he had a pile of 9. And he goes, if daddy drinks 3 of these a day, and he counts out groups of 3, these coffee pods are going to last him 3 days, mommy. So that's division. Now, if you set your 4-year-old down with a worksheet and try to teach him division, please don't do that. It won't work. It's not a good idea, right? Take it from me. Yeah. This discovery, first of all, it was sensory play. Those coffee pods have a lot of sensation going on with them. Second of all, I stayed out of it and I let him make that discovery. And he's going to remember that so much better than any algorithm I taught him on a worksheet ever. Right. And I know Lindsay sees this every day at the craft studio. So I'm probably singing your song, Lindsay.
No, I love it. I see it every day at the craft studio and I see it every day with my kids. You know, I have 3 kids and my 2 girls are both dyslexic. And I think I didn't even understand what neurodiversity was until I was on this journey with them. And I was so afraid of them being put in this box. And so our narrative has always been like, this does not define you. This is just a little part of you. And it's so interesting when you compare, you know, that like we talked about how our academic journeys were so linear, but you know, the coffee pot story, I've seen my girls when they're just playing with dolls, write out, menus of their cafe and they're doing the writing. And I know how flipped it is for, especially like my little one hasn't cracked her code yet. So her B's and D's are so hard. And she actually sees flipped and mixed up, like her letters are for her, how her dyslexia presents itself. But when she is playing and she is not stressed and feeling that pressure, she is writing out menus and practicing her letters and asking her sister. It's just so beautiful. And I think like sometimes backing up, and in the beginning of our journey, I was like, oh my gosh, we'll do alphabet soup every day and this and creative sensory play-based things. But sometimes they learn more just like when you step back. It's really amazing to see.
Lindsay, my kids too, I'll say that.
Like, we've
all got so much to say.
Yeah. No, Rachel, go ahead. Yes.
Thank you. You know, people ask me often, as soon as they hear I have a music school, and then they know, they hear I have 2 kids. I have 2 boys, they're 8 and 10 years old. And as soon as people hear that I have a music school, that what instrument do your kids play? They must be amazing at it, and they picture this world, I think, of them practicing 30 minutes a day and, producing, this kind of work and being able to play at this, proficiency. And with my kids, I've approached it totally the opposite. from when they were 2 years old, be below the level that we usually start at. Usually we start at 3 years old, but they wanted to start at two. They said to me they wanted to take lessons. So I just made it available to them. Okay, so I'll have a teacher come to the house. What instrument do you want to play? That we have instruments everywhere. They could pick which one they wanted for each lesson. They could, you know, change it up if they wanted to play ukulele 1 week and keyboard another week and wanted to play with the drumsticks. You know, I just made it all available to them. So my house was full of musical instruments, full of music, and it was available to them. And from one semester to the next, if either one of them said, I don't want to do it anymore, or they said, I want to change teachers or I want to change instruments, I just let them do it. And some people might say, well, if you hadn't done that, maybe your kids would be way, way better at the instrument that they play. And that's maybe true. But on the flip side, my kids both are, again, like you're all saying, very different learners. And they're also kids who don't have the best track record for continuing any activity that they've done long term. However, this has been something, the music lessons have been something that it's been woven through all of their years. Even if for a couple months they stopped, they wanted to start again, they wanted to continue. And I've never made them sit and practice. I've never told them, you have to do it. You have to play this instrument. And they have come to it on their own. And just recently, my 10-year-old, who has ADHD and is kind of all over the place and love him. And I hear him up in his room playing for Elise. Now, nobody taught him how to play for Elise. And I was very confused because he wasn't even taking piano lessons at the time. He's doing like beat production and learning how to do like playing like Roblox type songs. And he was sitting up there and listening to the demo song on the keyboard and taught himself how to play it by listening to it. And he just sat up there for hours and he surprised me to show me. And these are things that came completely from him. Nobody said you need to do this in a certain time frame. And that is the experience I want my kids to have with music and with creativity and with anything that's helping them with self-expression, to feel like it's something that they can access, that's available to them, and that can be on their terms, and that's okay.
So I want to share a story about my son that totally backs up what Rachel said. So my boys actually took piano lessons with somebody on Rachel's team. And we had to stop for a while. And the other day I went into the room and my older son is playing with two hands. Well, nobody taught him to play with both hands. That they hadn't gotten that far in his lessons. And I was like, when did that happen? Same idea. He was playing around the keyboard. We also have a, you know, keyboard that plays demo lesson, demo tracks. And he just started to tinker around with it and the sheet music and figure it out. And he, much like my coffee pod story, owns that. Right? He self-directed that and we made it possible with what was in the space. And now that he owns that in a way that would have been totally different if somebody had, you know, forced it down his throat. I think we're all sharing opportunities where we kind of created the environment for our child to be able to do it. So like, again, I think accessibility is key. I'm just saying, like this morning, my children, we have like an art cart in the kitchen. So it has just like,
so do we.
We have like loose materials. It's got the paper. It's got stickers. It's got, you know, all the things that they would need and that they're now age appropriate and can kind of go in and get and like self-directed. They just went in and they're like, we're going to write cards for our counselors. So like my eldest daughter wanted to do it. And fine motor skills is something that's really challenging for them. So like getting the opportunity to be working on something that's requiring the fine motor, mixed modality. They had stickers on it. They had different crayons, different pencils, all these different things. And they were so proud of it and like asked the questions as they needed to. And it did not look perfect. It was, you know, by no means accurate, but these were items that they were so proud of. And when they ran on the bus this morning, one of them had forgotten it. She's like, you need to grab it. You know, go get it. And I ran and grabbed it. And like, if you saw the smile emanating from my daughter this morning, it was beaming with pride and confidence. And like, she was taking that with her in such a beautiful way. So I guess my question is, we talked about accessibility. We talked about kind of giving them, letting it be child-led. What are some other ways that we can help encourage without kind of forcing so that we are helping to create kind of more confidence, more capability, all these different elements? Are there any other tips or strategies that any of you guys? Yeah, yes. I'm ready to go. Let me know.
Because it was in the story you were just telling too, and it's actually in Rachel's story too. So showing your kids that you value what they bring to the space, whether that's the learning space, that's the classroom, whether that's your home, whatever it is, the music lesson, the craft studio, right? Showing them that we value what they bring, even if it doesn't look like what we were expecting, even if it doesn't look like anybody else's, right? So in your story, she created this work to share with her counselor and forgot it. You showed her that you valued what she brought to this relationship with her counselor, right? Because you went back and got it when she said that, right? You didn't go, oh, we're going to be late. Just get on the bus. It's not a big deal. We'll buy her a card at Hallmark, right? So that idea of showing the kids that we value what they bring is absolutely huge.
Yeah.
Good job.
I was going to just say, somebody gave me this tip when I had my first, or when I was getting ready to have Vivi, my second. I was so nervous about not being able to spend time with Elle, my older daughter. And I felt so like, oh my gosh, like what, you know, am I ruining her life by bringing this other baby? And somebody said to me, Lindsay, if you can take 15 minutes of your day and get on the floor and play and lock eyes with your toddler who's getting this new baby that's going to take some of your attention, that dedicated 15 minutes of just being with them and focusing on them. And that's sort of how I've tried to parent from then on is obviously I wish I could spend 2 hours a day with each individual child, but there's not enough hours in the day. But when I have the opportunity, like Rachel, you're going to get the card and validating that, as Caitlin was pointing out, you know, whether it's I'm running her up to ballet and you know, where my daughter does ballet is literally the craft studio is underneath it. So it's so convenient. I can drop her and get in some work really quick. But I know how much she wants me to watch her. So staying for 5 minutes and peering through the window and locking eyes with her and the same going to pick her up like a little bit early, that gives that child such validation. And I see that in the studio too, when parents, you know, kind of are like, oh, that's great. But just that few minutes of wow, and asking the questions, you know, I love this, purple is really the color I'm focusing on today, guys. I was going to say, I love how you gave the horse purple streaks in their hair. What inspired you to do that? Asking questions and giving them a chance to explain their process, they light up inside like a Christmas tree. And it's so special.
I also think when you look at kids, like how they compare themselves with other people, and it's such human nature to compare ourselves with other people anyway, but taking those opportunities to help them see the things that they create as something that's from them and that's unique to them, that's something that if they didn't do it, I'm always saying this, if you didn't write that song, nobody else would have ever written it. That's just how creativity works. You are your own person. You have your own ideas. It's a particular moment in time. And realizing, helping kids realize that it's an opportunity for them to be entirely themselves and not worry about other people and what other people think and comparing it to other people, I think makes a huge difference. And we have a big end of the year concert every year, which is, of course, it is a performance. So it is, you know, the lessons are leading towards something. But we have parents say, oh my gosh, my kid just started 2 months ago. What do you mean? Or even 3 weeks ago, what do you mean they're invited to perform at this concert? And I'm like, wait a second. No, yes, it's on a big stage. It's like, you know, a big New York venue. But here's the thing. Everybody can play. It doesn't matter if they are brand new, if they've been playing for 10 years. And the idea is, if I ever heard, and I never have, I will say I've done it 15 years, I've never heard somebody laugh at somebody or mock somebody for not doing something well. The whole ethos and the whole idea is everybody can play. Everybody has something to share and meet them where they're at. And I think offering that kind of encouragement to kids and giving them a platform to celebrate where they are in that moment is really important to making them feel like good about their creative selves.
That's beautiful.
Describing the way in which you guys are creating inclusive environments. And I know, Caitlin, you know, specifically you had mentioned at the lead kind of creating a neurodiversity affirming practice. And it sounds like we're kind of touching on all the different ways that we're doing this, that like whatever it is that you create and giving value and meaning and purpose to it and showing your interest and wherever it is that they are, you know, that these are all really ways in which you guys are doing it. Are there other ways in which all three of you in the practices that you guys are working on are working to empower all individuals wherever they are? And again, I think we've kind of touched on a few different ways, but it's kind of been an undercurrent and a sentiment that everybody has shared in this, and kind of just want to unpack it a little bit more if there are other ways in which we can do this. And again, I shared kind of the lens of like, I have three very different children. And that goes across pretty much every single domain, you know, from reading and writing to sports, to music, to kind of across the chasm of things, of what feels good, of what doesn't feel good, of what they react positively to what things they might be turned off by, et cetera. And so I have worked to create an environment where each of them feel like I have a place, I have whatever my feeling is valid. You know, I have no two people are going to experience the exact same moment in time the same way. And that's okay, you know, whatever it is that you're feeling. But are there other ways in which in practice you guys are embodying this, empowering this, supporting this?
So any teacher who tells you that there's only one way to teach something is telling you what's easiest for the teacher and not what's best for your child. And I think that all three of us, I'm going to speak for you ladies, but I think all three of us really embody that every day in our work, right? There are so many different ways to teach a child. And if you begin by meeting the child where they are and with this strengths-based approach, and you are flexible and adaptable in what you do, then that's the value that you're living.
Haylen, can you like maybe dive into that a little? Can you like give an example of different types of learners or like what would that look like? So again, you had kind of said you have the chasm of all, you know, you have all different archetypes of children. So what does that look like in practice?
Okay, so I'll give you a story about, let me tell you a story about how we apply a strengths-based approach in our home, because I think maybe your listeners will find like, oh, that sounds great in the classroom, but like, what does that look like in my real life when I got a mess to clean up, right? So my kids at the time, they were 5 and 9, and they had taken this game that had like a million tiny parts and strewn it all over the living room floor. And it's one of these games that if you don't resort it into the box, the next time you play, it's not going to be fun, right? This was overwhelming to them, right? This is an executive functioning challenge. Now, my 5-year-old, my 9-year-old didn't know to call it that, but that's looking at it from my perspective, right? This is an executive functioning challenge. I have a task that feels too big and too overwhelming. I can't get started. I don't know how to break this down into pieces for myself so that I can take the steps I need, right? And so I have what an educator jargon would call barrier to task initiation, right? I can't get started, yeah? So I look at my kids and I know they're two, as you all have said, very different learners, and they have very different strengths. And I think, how can I use a strengths-based approach to help them build this executive functioning skill? This is a great opportunity, right? Now, I happen to have a moment.
I'm really proud of you in that moment, because, you know, like there are moments where I want to be doing this and in some might be not be feeling it. So props to you for recognizing and seeing and maintaining kind of that moment of calm. Yes.
So you anticipated what I was about to say, which is that I happened to have a moment where I felt regulated myself and I had the time to really do this, right? Like, no shade on any parents who look at that mess and go like, what have you done? We need to put it all right, right?
I had one of those this morning. So I was not in a regulated place. So that was not a teaching moment for me. We did not teach this morning yet.
So in this moment, I happened to be regulated. I had the time, I had the space. So I took advantage of the moment, right? So I look at my kids and I go, okay, my oldest, when he's feeling overwhelmed, he really likes to feel in control. That's his strength, right? So I said to him, okay, you're going to be cleanup manager, right? And you tell us what to clean up. Should we pick up everything blue first? Should we pick up everything made of paper first? You tell us. So right away now, I've given him an entry point that speaks to his strength. And like that, he turned it around and could get started. Now, my younger one is sensory seeking. His love language is touch. His strength is anything that involves physical touch. And so I said to him, you come and sit in my lap and your job is to clean anything you can reach from my lap without getting up. Don't get out of my lap, right? So now I'm tapped into his strength. He wants that physical touch. And now he has an entry point, right? I've made this feel manageable to them. So what have I done there? All those layers, if I put my educator hat on for a second instead of my mom hat, right? I've taught them a really valuable executive functioning skill. Here's a strategy to break down something that feels overwhelming so I get started. I've taught them to advocate for their strengths, because later in life, they're going to go out into the world and they're going to need to advocate for themselves when I'm not around, right? So maybe my oldest goes, you know what? If I'm in a group project and I'm feeling overwhelmed, maybe I can advocate and say, hey, can I be project manager, right?
Did you instruct or verbalize that to him, like, so that he's now unpacking, like, again, you're talking about self-advocacy, and I think it's so incredibly important, but how are you teaching your son, let's say the 9-year-old, this is your strength? Like, do you call it out? Is there language that you use? Is there, like, what is his way of knowing, or is it more intuitive just by kind of routine and systematic that he's doing it, and it just becomes kind of a learned behavior?
So this is a really interesting question, because earlier we were talking about not wanting to label them, right? Not wanting to create that external mythology of who they are. So how do we do that? How do we balance that? And I'm by no means perfect at it, don't get me wrong. But what I try to do with my kids is kind of a multiple fold approach. One is, in moments like that, I name the strength, not by saying like, you're really strong at this, but just saying like, hey, why don't you be our cleanup manager? And he immediately, when we speak to a child's strength as opposed to their deficit, they feel that. Yeah. Right? They feel a release of that stress or that burden, or they feel a connection to that. And in him, he demonstrated as like, oh, now I can get started. So I knew I'd hit the right note, right? If he hadn't been able to get started, I'd had to have adjusted and figured out what was, right? So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is that we're always talking about process in our family, right? So like, oh, I noticed that you had to try 5 different ways before you figured out how to make that thing work. That was really cool. I really loved watching that. You know, something that talks about the steps that they're taking, but it doesn't ignore the accomplishment, right? I think sometimes parents get jammed up here because they go, well, I'm not supposed to focus on the outcome. I'm not supposed to focus on like, you got an A on the test. But if I just focus on the like, you tried really hard, isn't that like ignoring that we have goals that we're trying to achieve, right? So it's a balance of recognizing and speaking about the process while also recognizing the accomplishment or the goal, you know, if there is one. It's not either or, right? I can hold conflicting or, truths at the same time. And then the third thing, and then I'm going to hand it over because I don't want to monopolize this question. The third thing is we're really honest with our kids about what other people say to them about them, right? So my older son is profoundly gifted. And when he was young, he had sort of radically accelerated mathematical abilities. And one day we were in the elevator and he pushed the button and somebody gets in who doesn't know him and says like, could you push 5? And he pushes 5 and it was 3. And the person goes like, oh, you're so smart. And my son, when the guy got off the elevator, my son looks at me, he goes, what did he mean? Like, what does that mean? And so what I said was, well, you know, when somebody says you're so smart, what they mean is I find what you just did really interesting. But maybe they haven't learned to make an I statement. So they said something about you and said, they said you're so smart instead of I found that really interesting. Right. So we're sort of creating that narrative for our kids from young ages around what other people around them might say about them.
Yeah.
Amazing. So interesting. I know at the craft studio from sort of, you know, I love listening to Caitlin because I could sit there and listen to how it applies in the academic world and then translates into everyday life all the time. And at the craft studio, it seems so simple, but how we sort of put this into practice is just like the positivity around it and the disarming of it, you know? So I think with art, it can still be intimidating. I know I was always intimidated to sit down in school with our art teacher and learn a new concept, like pointillism. Oh my gosh, my project's never going to look like the teacher's. So I think, as I mentioned before, like all of our projects are going to be different, but also throughout the process, really, you know, as they're doing all the different steps, like rolling the sensory balls and the paint, like, wow, I never thought to take the ball after I roll it in the paint and kind of bounce it like that. That's so cool. And just really throughout the process, not just at the finished product, you know, give them these disarming, you know, positive statements. I think that, again, everyone is an artist and kids, even in today's world, feel nervous when they see a blank canvas in front of them, you know, or a blank, you know, plaster, a blank sheet of paper. So our team really just tries to encourage them. And what is art anyways? You know, art is just a glob of paint on a paper. Some of the most famous art look like finger paint, you know. So that's where I see kids really relax and get their hands dirty and start to believe the truth of that they are an artist.
So. Love that, and kind of naming it as they're going too.
Helps
them feel more comfortable in like whatever the choices are. So, like you're saying, that positive feedback to them while they're doing it. It was funny. My son's teacher used to refer to them as juicy details. So like getting juicy details to it. So like it's great though, because then when we're unpacking it, like he'll be like, oh no, I have to still add some more juicy details, and he gets like it was even just like a way in which she was saying it, and like getting him to want to like to probe and to try and to do more. Cause I think like in the beginning, again, like you said, it could be overwhelming. It's like there's this white empty space, and however he was going to narrate his story through his art, It was something that was like empowering because it was like, I'm controlling what I'm adding to it. And I'm going to more and more by adding to this. And it felt like it was empowering. It was empowering.
Also
empty canvas.
Totally. And one more thing about like how Caitlin said, it's tricky because like, do we not say great work when they get the A, but when they're finished with a project, we make sure and not just say, wow, that looks, that's so beautiful. But oh my goodness, like, wow, on your Under the Sea Sunken Treasure birdhouse, you use the tinfoil to make a tin, like, that's so creative. So highlighting what makes their project unique and different instead of just like blanket statements like, this is beautiful, you know?
Are there ways for each, like that each of you, one in your own homes and or suggest to people outside of kind of like coming into the craft studio or doing kind of one of the places that you have kind of like the pop-ups and or coming for the music and or going and working with you, Caitlin, or any of the other educators kind of in your sphere? Like, what are ways that you suggest to parents to kind of unlock the creativity? Like, how do you tap into that? You know, leave out lots of instruments, leave out lots of, what is it? What are the suggestions and or tips and or advice kind of from each of your different domains?
I have one really good one. And I'm sorry to jump in because I just talked, but I find what sometimes when my kids, actually all three, this applies to all three of them, have too many things to choose from, it's very overwhelming for them. So we have a whole art bar in our house. My kids are at work with me all the time, especially in the summer. Like, they've done little bits of camp, but they're really with me at the studio, either doing camp or just kind of hanging out. And when I separate just like oil pastels and put them down and piece of paper, or when it was really hot, we made ice cube watercolors and just like the cookie sheets, the paper and the ice cube watercolor paint, and that's it. They will do it for hours. And I back away, and it's almost as if when there's too much for them to choose from. And the same goes in the studio. There's so many options, which I love because there's something for everyone. But when we pull it apart in a lesson and we're playing with this specific medium, I really think the kids sort of just relax into it, and they feel less overwhelmed. And I think a lot of it has to do, I am no expert, but like the screens, there's so much going on all the time. And when they can focus on one thing and then go for it and see what happens, I'd see that where in my own home, the magic happens. If we have bins in our living room organized, they get disorganized all the time, but it always starts fresh. And I think, oh, there's so much to choose from. It's overwhelming for my 4-year-old son. So instead, if I take out 3 trucks and put everything else away, he's like, oh, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's such a good point. And I think that I love that, Lindsay. I love that you do that. And it reminds me of, I used to be a preschool teacher, and it reminds me of like setting up the classroom for the kids and putting a couple of things on the table so they're not having to, so they can, of course, they can come in and they can take something else out if they so choose, but giving them access to just a moment where they can walk up and do something. And I love that. And I was thinking from a music perspective, a lot of parents, what I've kind of discovered as I've grown up is that a lot of people don't listen to a lot of music at home. They may think they do, or they may think of themselves as somebody who listens to music, and they may love music. I mean, most people love music in some way. Everybody has their favorite song. They have their favorite music. But when it comes to kids and music, there's a lot of people who end up just catering to what the kids kind of gravitate towards when they're very young. And then it becomes something that becomes like very contentious, where the parent is like, I don't want to listen to Frozen again and again and again. And it becomes kind of like a problem instead of something that's joyous. And in my household, and we are not perfect, and everybody has their kids and their people and their dynamic, and But in my house, what we did is my husband and I are huge music lovers. We just love music, and we love music of all different kinds. And we just played music from day one. There was always music on, and it was always music that we loved. And when the kids were really little, they would request like the Grateful Dead. They would request like old blues songs and old folk and bluegrass and different things. And those would be their favorite songs. And it's not that they never heard the soundtrack to one movie or another, but it wasn't really an option for them to just play those on repeat. And I'm not saying that you should, I'm not judging that at all, because lots of people, that's just how you get through the day and that's what your kids gravitate toward. But I think having the environment set up in a way that they feel like it's just part of the fabric of their lives, and music is something that that is just on and available to them, musical instruments around, and showing kids, and I think this goes with art, music, with anything creative, anything in life. If you show as a parent that you do it too, and that you do it without judgment of yourself, I think it makes a really, really big difference. So if you can sit there and you can draw with them, and instead of saying, I'm terrible at drawing, terrible at this, or saying, this isn't any good, it doesn't even look like a flower, like, you'll do a better job than me. That's teaching them, like, to look at somebody else creating art in that way, which is not the lesson we really want them to learn, versus sitting there with them and kind of just showing them the enjoyment of sitting and drawing and having conversation and talking about other things and using it as a window into them and into your relationship. So that's all really important to me. And I think it can be really helpful as a parent, as a teacher, to consider that, that kind of point of view.
We talk about this with reading and writing in our house all the time, because I have parents ask me all the time, oh, how do you get your kids to sit down and read? How do you get them to write for fun? You know, how do I get my child to do what your child is doing? And one of my first questions is, well, do you model that at home? Like, do you sit down and read, or do you have journaling time or anything like that in your day? And the thing is, when our kids are young, they really want to spend time with us and they really want to do what we do. And we can maximize the power of that by saying, like, okay, you know, on Sunday evenings, we sit down and we do our journaling, you know, we cuddle up on the couch and we do our journaling for, even if it's 15 minutes, right, whatever it is, or, you know, making a priority to every day have family read aloud. There are benefits to brain development of hearing reading out loud until much older ages than most people think. So if my kids will let me read aloud to them, even when they're in high school, like, I'm still going to be doing that, right? And we have this idea that it has to be bedtime reading. That happens to work really well for my family, but it doesn't have to be. You could have breakfast reading, right? You could listen to an audiobook together on the commute to school. Like, find a way that it works authentically for your family, because that's going to set you up for success to keep doing it. Don't try to make it look like what you think somebody else's Instagram version of it looks like, and so yours has to match, right? But if we can engage in these activities with our kids, even if it's parallel, right? I'm writing in my journal, he's writing in his journal, at a young age, then they're developing that practice that's going to carry them through to a much older age. Much easier than looking at your 14-year-old and going, okay, now I want you to sit down and journal for an hour, even though you've never done it before. Go.
Right. It's, yeah. As you were saying that, I was just thinking, mine was kind of like a twofold for this summer. Like, in self-care for myself, I started reading much more rigorously, I'll say, than I have in a really long time. And it was something that was always like an escape for me. And I loved reading. And I'm going to be very honest with this group here. It's romance novels. That's like my genre of self-care. And so I had like taken a very, I'd say, a 7.5-year break from kind of like reading and engaging in kind of this like very, very engaged, very rapt way. And I started the summer again, and the rate at which my children are now picking up books increased like exponentially, you know, just by watching me anytime they saw me, and like we weren't engaged in kind of play together, and or I was doing something else with them. But like, I was mindful about taking opportunity when we were in shared spaces to be reading, you know, and it was something that I did kind of very regularly. And
I had the same experience this summer. I was, for so long, I felt guilty that if I'm not with my kids, I should be working, right? And I was like, this has to stop, because it's not a good example for them. So I really started getting into reading more. A friend of mine started a mom's morning book club after preschool drop-off. And it's like it's not very frequent, but it got me back into reading. And this summer, I said, I am going to enjoy myself. And when I'm sitting with them at the pool or at the beach, I'm not going to always be writing curriculum or always. And seeing my girls bring out their books to the chair, like, you know, my girls are at different points with their dyslexia journey. And my 9-year-old has cracked her code, and she like reads chapter books and she loves to read. And my little one, it's still a struggle, but she would bring her little books out too. And just, I know, even as she was only reading every other word because she's not there yet, she was sitting with her book. So yeah, it resonates so much with me, Caitlin, what you just said, and Rachel, it sounds like you and I were on a similar journey with that. And my books were not that I was reading like very fluffy, fun beach reads too. So
Lindsay and I have talked about this because I have Orton Gillingham training, which is an approach to teaching reading to kids with language-based learning differences like dyslexia. And one of the other things we do is to value lots of different ways to read, right? Or to write. And so if my younger son brings an audiobook, and we get these playaways now from the library. If you guys don't know about those, they're awesome. It's like an individual audiobook you can take out from the library. Just plug your headphones in. It's ready to go. If he brings in his audiobook, we are sharing in a reading activity, and I treat it that way. Like, oh, at the end of my chapter, at the end of he's listened to his chapter, oh, what was yours about? Here's what mine was about, right? I'm not devaluing any mode of doing this, right? If his access point is reading his Pokemon cards right now versus reading a chapter book, I'm still valuing that. That's still part of reading, right? Or if he's reading street signs when we're out and about, he's super into geography right now. So if he's reading maps and directional signs when we're out, right? This is all part of that practice. So I encourage parents not to feel like, oh gosh, now I have to create special like learning time in my already hectic, busy day. When am I supposed to do that? You're going to be the most successful if you're doing it integrated into what you already have to do during your day. So that's like my example of like audiobook in the car on the commute to school or whatever, right?
I think also with my kids on the reading tip, we have a house, you might not be surprised, we have a house full of music and books. There's books everywhere. And we're big readers, but actually I say that, like, am I a reader? I don't know if I'm a reader anymore. I was a big reader. And we have books all over. The kids are really big readers, and my husband is a big reader. I'm like more of the workaholic and need to take Lindsay's tip and just kind of, and Rachel, like, I just need to like take a second and
sometimes
read
the
one.
Knowing you're doing it for the benefit of your child makes it easier too.
Like, okay.
You're benefiting your child and you. This is a win-win. It's a good one.
I'm going to try that. Yeah. But I have heard a lot of judgment from parents around me as my kids are in elementary school and as they're kind of growing a little older around graphic novels and concerns about whether graphic novels are like real books and all this kind of stuff. And my kids love graphic novels, so really, really big on them. And I've just let it go. They can read graphic novels, whatever they come to, whatever kind of book they want to read, like Caitlin was saying, they are, that's what they go for. Without any judgment, I don't say, oh, what? Why are you reading that? You could be reading a novel. You could be doing this. And, oh, what's that book about? What do you, you know, and they reread books and they, you know, and they're getting so much out of it. And then today, just to say, my son, who had given up Harry Potter in the middle of book five, which I've heard has like a little bit of like a leap in it, like a developmental leap that makes it a little harder in the middle of book five for kids to kind of continue. And he today, after months and months and months of reading graphic novels, packed book five, Harry Potter, as his book to take to camp so that he could read it at lunchtime. And I thought, how different would this have been if I had said, you have to finish Harry Potter before you can go to the next book. I'm not gonna get you another book until you finish this. We need to finish what we started. You know, this is a lesson on, you know, how different is it to say, this is reading, it's all reading, and now find your way. And see what you enjoy.
Now, for parents to hear this and go, okay, but one day he's going to have to be able to analyze Fitzgerald because he's going to be in high school or college and like they're going to assign Great Gatsby, you know? I hear that fear. And this is a great opportunity to think back to that strengths-based approach. Because if your child loves reading graphic novels, that's a strength, right? Reading graphic novels is a strength. So let's imagine we have a book, Babysitter's Club, which I loved as a kid and my parents thought were too easy for me. So I'm remembering this acutely in my own childhood, right? And your child's reading the Babysitter's Club graphic novels. Well, that's a great opportunity to say, hey, you know, that series that you love those graphic novels of, they're actually chapter books of those that will give you like more detail and more depth if you're really interested in those characters in that story. And you don't have to push it, but you've made that connection now. You used the strength to make a bridge for your child, put that chapter book in the space and wait and see if they're gravitating toward it, right? That's Rachel, you gave me a beautiful example.
Yeah. And Rachel, I have to say too, graphic novels is what made my daughter not completely want to give up. Like when she would go to the school library and she could check out a graphic novel because it's something she could handle. It like I hold a special place in my heart for graphic novels because she could use her other skills, like, you know, looking ahead and the pictures to imprint what was happening, even though she couldn't read the words, now this girl crushes chapter books on her own time. She cracked her code and figured it out. But like, I'm with you on that 100%. And also, I love what you said, Caitlin, about, you know, how you reflecting it on for later on. Rachel, what you described about him going back to Harry Potter, I had that as epiphany as an adult because I really stopped reading because I would start books and then never finish. And it would be a book that really didn't capture me, but I had in my head, oh, I got to go finish this book. So we did a big clean out donation of different things in our home. And I had a stack of books that prevented me from reading for so long because I wasn't so into them, but I felt that intrinsic pressure to finish it. And I donated them to somebody else who will love them. But as an adult, I put that into practice.
It's the exact same thing. And I had the exact same hurdle. I thought because I was the type who like had to finish the book. And I was like, why? This is not bringing me any joy. I'm not like, there is nobody telling me I need to read this book. I could just stop reading this. I literally was having this discussion at the beginning of the summer. And I'm like, and I was like, I don't have to finish the book.
No.
This book to somebody else who might like this book. But this book's not for me. And I'm done with this book.
Yeah. Now it comes full circle, right? It comes full circle because is that something somebody told you about yourself at some time when you were younger that like you have to finish this book to be a reader and you've now released that? That's exactly what we're talking about, right?
We're no longer serving me to finish these books. I will not. And I actually picked up my graphic novel game as well. I was like very, very engaged in them as a child. And my husband started sprinkling them into the house for me also, knowing that it was something that like brought me joy and happiness and also was a pathway back in for me. So not just for kids. I have like 100 more things I want to talk to all of you about, but I'm going to tap into our lightning round. And at the very end of it, so I'll give you a moment to kind of think through if there are any other like last minute advice, tips, resources, et cetera, that kind of you would be remiss if we didn't share. So while that is kind of percolating in the background, I'm going to go to a lightning round where feel free to give kind of like a short anecdote or something if it kind of comes to mind, because I think a lot of these kind of touch into the nostalgia and the personal element of it. Again, I'll kind of go down the line. Lindsay, you're first for me, then Rachel and Caitlin. So what was your favorite play activity as a child?
I was really into potion making. It's my earliest memory of kind of discovering things on my own. I would do it with kids in the neighborhood. I'd do it by myself. My poor parents, I would go in the pantry and get the vanilla and this whatever and mix things up and probably empty jars of things that I shouldn't to have it be the base for filling the potion and add glitter. Something about mixing things together, I just loved it. And, you know, as I got older, I was in a pre-Milky Race club with my neighborhood friends and we would go out in the neighborhood and find things to put in our potions.
I love that potion making.
Mm-hmm.
I think my favorite, I spent a lot of time making dollhouses like from scratch, and I would use like shoe boxes and tape and staplers and scissors and put everything together and make like big houses. I'd make stables for my toy horses, Asperian horses, and make saddles. I'd go to the craft store and get felt and foam and use all kinds of things to make saddles and bridles and all kinds of things like that. I'd use wrapping paper for wallpaper of the house and, you know, popsicle sticks for fences and things like that. And I really loved that whole world of imagination that I could have with making it all from scratch.
So I used to draw these elaborate houses as though, you know, imagine like a big piece of poster paper and imagine that you'd taken a house and you'd like cut away the front of it and you could see inside. And I would fill every room with like all the details, all the furniture, the artwork on the walls. I had a big thing for like swimming pools on the deck off the second story, like cantilevered. I don't know what was going on there. Right. And I would just create these.
We're ahead of the bar, you know.
Yeah. And I could just spend hours immersed in these house drawings down to like the tiny detail of the teacup on the table.
I love that. I love that all of you, it was like a creative outlet for you. And obviously you guys all grew up in households that kind of fostered that, because I don't think many households would you know, allow unlimited potion building and dollhouse building and kind of the what you're describing. So it's beautiful. And again, I love that you guys were all able to kind of tap into unlocking your own creativity through the play that you guys enjoyed as kids. I was like way more rigid and regimented, just in like, I eventually became an engineer, kind of tracks in terms of where my brain was at. And I think I was afraid. I had a mother who was like very artistically inclined. I had a sister who was very artistically inclined, and it was like, I'm the math person. So like mine was like very blocks and, you know, like my creative elements would be like breaking things apart and then figuring out how to build them back together again. That was like
very impressive.
That was like the way that my operated. But it's nice because like now without I've like gone back into drawings of like I enjoy drawing like architectural drawings, and without the fear of like it has to be perfect, but just like I love drawing. I love it. I love putting pencil or whatever it is, whatever, you know, medium I'm using onto paper. And it's, again, it's like unlocking something inside of myself, and my kids enjoy watching me do it. And likewise in kind, you know, now are much more apt in the morning to want to draw and to kind of work with that. So anyway, that's beautiful. Is there one item in your house that you find to be a great toy but is a non-toy? So like an everyday item that has unlocked the gift of play and the, kind of the joy of what typically would be found within a toy.
I feel like this is a very boring answer, but the truth is my recycle bin. Everybody plays with the cardboard tube still. Everybody, if there's a box, they'll color it. They'll make it into a fort. It's a huge joke, right? That the best toys are cardboard boxes. My kids love the recycling bin and cardboard. Like they just will, they'll turn it into, my 9-year-old took the 2 toilet paper rolls and another piece of cardboard, made a little desk for her dolls the other day. Luke made some sort of telescope, the 4-year-old. I feel like cardboard in our home.
My four-year-old turned himself into Boxman. I had to help him with the eye cutouts, but he turned himself into Boxman 2 days ago or whatever.
I love it.
So yes, yes, yes.
I don't know if it's exactly what you're asking, but one of the things that I do with my kids, and I did from when they were really little, was I would actually give them my phone, which I don't mean like give them my phone and let them sit in my phone, but I would give them the voice memos in my phone and let them go around and record sounds that they hear. And it was actually a really interesting exercise because it gave them a chance to really listen to like what sounds the things around you make. Like, what does the refrigerator sound like? What does the backyard sound like? Like things that you're usually kind of not tuned into, giving the kids a chance to tune into them. And then I would take those sounds, because I'm a musician and have this like experience, but I would take those sounds into GarageBand on the iPad and let them make, like mix them together and loop them and layer them and make tracks out of them and make beats. And they really loved that. And it was kind of like, we made these like found sound symphonies where they could kind of compose their own music all based on sound that they'd hear in the house.
Awesome. Rachel, I'm stealing your idea. That's amazing.
I know. Make voice memos and then
voice memo.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So cool.
I also love, for what it's worth, kind of related but tangential, but I do let them do voice recordings too sometimes, not just like the sounds, but like also selfishly for myself, and like listening to it over time of like hearing your child at a certain age or stage or kind of like what they were into. There are these like little snapshots back into who they were at that moment in time. I think it's just like such a powerful medium. So
I'll give you a tip related to that before you give me my answer. You know how kids come home with an influx of artwork, and Lindsay, I know you know, but our kids come home with an influx of artwork, right? And it's always like, what do we save? What do we not save? What do we do with it? What I do now is I have my kids, I take a video, a short video of them like once a month, holding up all the artwork, describing it. What was it about? What did it mean to them? Because I have that snapshot in time. Same thing. Like I look back and I'm like, oh, their little voice and like their little drawing at that age. And that way I sort of alleviate some of my mom guilt about not keeping it all.
Yeah, that's great.
But also, what a gift for them. Like my kids love looking back over time and like seeing and hearing and knowing, and like what a gift you're giving them of like also the details that are associated with it. Because like you'll never get that moment back in time of how they felt in that moment when they did it and saw it and what was going through their head. So what a gift that is to like carry the process with them that they'll now know too. Oh, that's so.
And I don't stick to it every month. I wish I did, but just to not create like more mom guilt and pressure for anybody listening, like as often as you can do it, it's fine.
Yeah.
My answer
when you remember, do it.
My answer to your lightning round question is anything little that can be collected or grouped or divided into groups, like my story with the coffee pods is a perfect example. I think in our house, we've always talked about math is a language that people have created to describe what they observe happening in the world around them. And so in that way, math is everywhere and it's not just calculations on a page. And one of the ways my kids have really like taken to that is anytime there's like a little collection of something, it becomes this exploration of the way math describes what's happening in the world. So the Nespresso pods, or my younger son did this with seashells on the beach. He collected a bunch of shells. And then while we were like waiting for our lunch to be ready at the takeout counter on Martha's Vineyard, he's like sorting them into rows and groups, right? And again, like I'm not controlling that. So I would have to say anything that comes in a little bunch of pieces in a collection is the one for us.
Okay, so I'm also going to suggest, I don't know if any of you are into this, but exactly what you're describing, kind of like how math is a language for describing what, here's looking at Euclid. It was my husband's first Valentine's Day gift to me, and it was one of like my most favorite books that I ever read, and it has like all these highlights and flags and whatever have you, and it's all about kind of understanding why and how math is a language unto itself for describing and anyway, it was great and I really loved it. And it was really, it was very punny.
Totally just wrote it down.
It was very funny. So I would, you know, that always draws me in. It was a myth. Anyway, it was a very well done one, but it's literally describing exactly what you just did. And for me, it was like, it was like a gift unpacked in that capacity. So anyway, I share that with you.
Awesome.
Okay, before we go, is there any tip, advice, last thought that you would like to leave everybody with? Again, I've just, I would love to sit here with you guys for like 3, 4, or 5 more hours and just kind of dive in and discuss more things. But if there was one thing you wanted to leave everybody with, is there anything else?
I would say just like, you know, kind of creativity is everywhere. It's like sounds cheesy, but it's like kind of with Caitlin's example of all the little like collections and, you know, so many things that Lindsay said, there's just this idea of not putting creativity in a box. Like it doesn't have to be so so directed. Like it really doesn't have to be music lessons or art lessons, or I mean, I encourage all of those things, and at the same time you can just really think of how math is art too. Like all of these things are, science is art. Like there are ways that you can bring kind of creativity into everything that your kids do, and it opens their minds and makes them feel more connected to the world and to the people around them. And it helps them get to know themselves better, which I think as parents is what we really want. We really want our kids to know themselves and see themselves as who they are in the world.
I would say that learning is everywhere and you can't stop your kids from learning even if you tried. So the more that we can release the mom guilt and the pressure we put on ourselves for our kids to conform to some standard of performing their learning, that happier we'll be, the more regulated, supportive parents will be for our kids, which is what they need from us. And when I say that learning is everywhere and you couldn't stop them if you tried, they're going to learn best by what they can touch and feel and taste and get their hands dirty with versus, you know, algorithms on a calculations on a page or, you know, something like that. So, you know, get out there. You have a child who's interested in bridges, like take a drive, find a covered bridge, look at it, get out of the car, smell it. What does the wood smell like? Run your hands on it if you're not going to get splinters, right? Like that is going to be more memorable to them than an entire textbook about the engineering of bridges, right? So again, it's everywhere and you can build it. Listen, we do math waiting online for the bouncy house. We're at a carnival. There was a long line for a bouncy house. And I was like, okay, guys, I need my kids not to go crazy in this line. It's a long wait. Count how many people are in this line ahead of us. Okay, awesome. There are 10 people ahead of us. Did you notice they're letting 2 people in at a time? So how many groups of 2 are going to go in before it's our turn, right? Like it's there. It's there for you. You don't have to buy all the things and set aside the special time. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
All that is amazing. And I think just a note, which I am trying to model is do to yourself what you do for your kids. Don't put boundaries on yourself. Don't make yourself feel like you have to be perfect. And if you make a mistake,
model for your kids? Like, hey, we all make mistakes. I try and call out every time I make a mistake, whether it's doing something for work that turned out not the way I wanted. I think just opening the door for creativity and a lifelong love of being creative is modeling kind of that behavior and being kind to yourself and acting the same way and teaching through modeling.
I'm so grateful to all of you, and what a gift all of you are to the communities that you're in, to the kids in your own household, all the advice and tips that you've provided to everybody on this. So a big thank you. And like, again, just hats off. It's a lot. You're all juggling a lot and also impacting people so positively and enriching their lives. And I think there's so much, I think we all said it. It's like the education also has to happen for us at our level so that we're able to impact and kind of create a generation that's able to come up feeling empowered, feeling confident, being, you know, through all the different mechanisms that you guys described. So a big, big thank you. And again, just I'm in awe of all of you and what you're doing. And I'm so grateful that you guys joined. So thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to continued conversations.
Thank you so much. Right back at you.
And I would just add, I always think conversations like this are the start of something and not the ending. So anybody listening who wants to continue this conversation, come find us on Instagram. I'm just at Caitlin Greermeister. Lindsay and Rachel, I'm sure you can share yours. Like, let's keep talking. I love what I do.
They'll be in the crib notes for everybody at the end. So you'll share all of your Instagram handles, all of your resources for work. And if there's anything else that you guys want to share, please do. And we'll make sure that it gets added into there as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
For more information on sensory play activities and resources, check out the links in our show notes below. And of course, don't forget to like, share, subscribe to this channel, and check out our sponsor EduShapes website and social media pages for more insightful conversations on all things toys and child development.